I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Today on Off Tackle Empire, 9 overtimes. Yes, yes. Sicko's game of the decade candidate. And also other things happened, but did you really watch them? No, you didn't. Haha, yes.
Your source for Big Ten talk, it's Off Tackle Empire.
Welcome back to Off Tackle Empire, the only college football podcast with the pleasant thickness to keep you warm during these fall turning into winter months when, you know, when the skinny boys are just not going to keep you warm at night. You're going to need the warm embrace of the Off Tackle Empire podcast and all of the Big Ten things that we cover here.
Yes. Yes.
Once again, we are noted sickos, Steve Braun, a.k.a. Thumpsaurus, with Andrew Kaczewski, and we're here to talk about Big Ten football.
And this week, there's really only one thing to talk about. We'll get to everything else, I guess, eventually at some point, but...
Well, I'm going to crack and pour a Win, Fight, Try Brewster of the Week, and this is by Pigeon Hill Brewing Company in Muskegon, and it is Cinnamon on French Toast, and I'm not going to lie about what this is. It is a barrel-aged imperial stout. Now look, the craft beer scene's been around for a while. I get that the hip, sexy thing is always going to be these West Coast IPAs. Now you have these New England-style IPAs. I don't get in the middle of that rat beef at all because you know what? Out here in Michigan, out here in the heartland, what we're known for is this very thick, very rich and fattening and very decadent style of beer. Now look, it takes you longer to finish. It's it doesn't pour a crisp golden color. It usually just has this very black, very thick opacity to it.
It can be a struggle to get through.
Yep, it can be a struggle. It really can. But you know what? It's what we do here. Okay, so maybe you West Coast or Southeast. I don't even know if they have craft beer in the Southeast. I'm sure they do.
It's just North Carolina's got a pretty good beer scene.
No, I know they do. But point is, what we're known for in Michigan is this kind of thing. You may not like it, but this is what ideal male performance looks like.
Is it? All right. There you go. Top that off. And let us wait no further then to get into the Sickos game, perhaps of the decade, certainly of the year. That would be Illinois 20, Penn State 18 in 9 overtimes. 9 overtimes, 9 overtimes.
There are, to me, between 3 and 4 angles to talk about here. There is...
They're playing more, but go ahead.
There is, 1, what Illinois did. 2, what Penn State allowed to happen. 3, how funny this was. And 4... how funny this was.
And 5, how funny this was. I had to write, so when I'm able to be in the house watching college football on a Saturday, as I was most of the day yesterday, I try to get started and kind of write down impressions on some of the games as they're happening, especially in the noon slate. And I had to change the thing on this like 5 times because the game kept going. By the time it was over... It was on ABC, and it was supposed to roll over into the game day game, which was UCLA, Oregon. Some of the letters are the same, but you can see how it confused those two schools. Very similar places, LSU and UCLA. But by the time this game was over and they switched over to it, they were at the end of the first quarter, and so that was the break where Fowler and Herbstreit had to set up the game and kind of explain, oh yeah, this is what happened in the entire first quarter that the national audience missed as the game day broadcast was kicked over at ESPN News. So I thought that was an amusing one.
So yeah. So I guess because we also didn't mention when we introduced this, Illinois, 2-5 Illinois, 20, number 7 Penn State.
Yeah.
At home. So
if I may, before you get into it, I think there's basically two entirely separate parts to this game, which is what happened in regulation and then the overtime.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because really, Illinois, if you look at the stats and you look at just the way the game flow went, Illinois probably should have won this game in regulation.
By two scores, yeah.
And the biggest reason they didn't is because the quarterback play is so terrible.
Yeah.
And it's great that they managed to make a big statement win while still allowing me to complain about having the worst quarterback play probably in the country, because Art Sitkowski was remarkably ineffective, and yet
at no point were you thinking, we really need to go to the backup, right? Because you knew what that would mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I knew that they were never going to put in a quarterback with wheels, because that's just antithetical to everything that Brett Bielema wants to do, although did see Ryan Johnson warming up on the sideline at some point, but I have no idea what he's capable of. He must just be around for comic relief if he can't get any snaps over Peters and Sitkowski. But both of these teams had bye weeks last week, and my take in the aftermath of the Wisconsin game for Illinois was, I get that it was a daunting challenge, but why didn't we try to run the ball? We know that we're good at that. We know that we're terrible at passing the ball. So we're going to fail at passing the ball against everybody. So we should at least, even if we're doomed to fail, try running the ball a bit.
If for no other reason than because running the ball will shorten the game and lessen the pressure on your defense, which exactly. held up to Wisconsin for a while.
Because that's what I was saying. I was saying the only way we beat Wisconsin is we shorten the game and, you know, just one play, one weird turnover that Illinois has been remarkably good at.
Or Chase Brown breaks a run, which, yeah, you know.
Something happens and that's... And all of a sudden it's a one-score game or it's a tie game or something. I'm just wondering, why didn't we do that? But, you know, I don't think I'm a savant or anything, but it was an obvious question, right? Having the reigning Big Ten player of the week get 8 carries. And it looks like during the bye week, Brett Bielema went, hey, why didn't we run the ball against Wisconsin? That's the same question that all of us did. And they came out basically doing what I thought they should have done against Wisconsin, which is to, hey, even if we're not having any success down to down, all that's going to happen if we try to throw the ball is bad things. But they ran the ball really well. I guess Brett Bielema didn't lose the locker room when he talked about the offensive line depth chart situation. Got ripped by Zombie Deadspin, of all things, for that.
Yeah, and you mentioned... It's so Illinois ran for over 350 yards, and yeah, there were overtimes in this, but keep in mind, after two overtimes, there are no more yards added, really, because you go back, you go to the alternating two-point thing. So yeah, there's a few extra yards that would have come in the overtime sessions, but to run for 350 yards, and that's with Art Sitkowski taking 4 sacks on 19 pass attempts. So that they got this kind of rushing production and had so much trouble putting it in the end zone tells you that, yeah, because the air attack was so impotent, Penn State's able to absolutely cram the box in the red zone and deny the run game, and Illinois, through the air, had no answer for that. That's part of the reason that this game went so long in the overtime sessions is because, for whatever reason, for, like, the first 7 overtimes, like, so, again, there's the first 2 overtimes, which are more normal games, and then once we got into the 2 points, Illinois threw it like the first 5 or 6 of those attempts, and you've got like Dan Orlovsky in the booth being like, yeah, I think you got to put the ball in the hands of the quarterback and throw it here. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, and the thing is, Penn State knew that Illinois was going to try to run it, because why would you try to do anything else? I mean, the crazy thing is that Illinois was not wrong to do everything they could to limit the opportunity of their quarterback, because if you told me that they got nearly 400 yards and they passed for less than 40, I would have said that that's not surprising at all. In fact, at the end of the game, what with a tie game situation, They got the ball back because Penn State, of course, playing for overtime at home against 2-5 Illinois, which we'll get to the Penn State angle in a second here. But
yeah, we're coming.
You know, Illinois, in my opinion, very smart. I mean, usually I want the coaches to be aggressive here, but I also understand there is no quarterback, maybe that I've ever seen, more likely to lose you the game right here than Art Sitkowski from his own three. And so on the first snap, I think he fakes a handoff and runs back into the end zone. but they ran it like 11 times during this. I mean, I don't think that's an actual number, but they got in nearly into field goal range just by running the ball.
Yeah,
which I mean shows an incredible amount of awareness, because you usually don't want to accept the fact that your quarterback is way more likely to lose the game for you than he is to make a good play. But that's kind of what we're dealing with here. That's
yeah, and there's just, I mean, you go up and down this box score, and there's no end. It's like watching a classic old movie, and every time you see it, it's like, oh man, there's another little detail or nuance I never know. It's like watching like a Jurassic Park or a Raiders of the Lost Ark or something. Yeah. And every time you go back to it, you see something else like, oh wow, that's what, like...
At the end of the day, though, what happened was that both the Fighting Illini coordinators, everybody involved in this game plan, had by a wide margin their best day as Illini. I mean, Tony Peterson really redeemed himself. Of course, Ryan Walters has been the standard bearer all year. He's been doing some really great work outside of the Virginia game.
Virginia and UTSA, which UTSA, again, the UTSA yeah. game ages better by the week, by the way, as they're still undefeated.
But he's been doing fantastic work, and you saw, you know, even though Illinois turned it over three times, one in their own territory, Penn State didn't do very much with those at all. They scored 10 points in regulation, and Brian Walters was... So basically, what this boils down to is, I said this in Sunday morning coming down, you think of what would a good Brett Bielema Illinois team look like someday that we would have, right? It would be one that runs the ball pretty relentlessly, that also you just make fun of because the quarterback play is terrible, and doesn't give up explosive plays on defense, because then, you know, it just wants to shorten the game there, right? In every way, kind of. It's a bit like Kirk Ferentz, but with slight variations on exactly what avenue they take to try to do these things.
Yeah, it's Ferentz ball, but just running more man instead of zone. So
yeah, exactly. And this is what they did. I mean, what more of a statement can you make as Brett Bielema about your Illinois program than getting a big win over a top 10 team on the road while setting the record, all-time record for rushing attempts in a Fighting Illini game, when you consider that we used to have Howard Griffith in Lou Tepper's offense, where he didn't understand the point of the quarterback, right? The fact that the Lou Tepper era came and went and never put up as many rushing attempts in a game as this.
Yeah, well, I mean, think even more recently, where this is... Again, more rushing attempts than you had with Mikel LeShore or Rashard Mendenhall. Like, there have been some recent incredible running attacks that have not produced anything like this. And so mammoth games from Chase Brown and Josh McCray. I mean, either of them would have been a decent candidate for Big Ten Player of the Week. I think Chase Brown's an obvious candidate for Big Ten Player of the Week.
Even 223 yards on 33 carries for... And not only is that a great line, but again... When you think of the upside, what would it look like if Brett Bielema's Illinois was good?
Yeah.
33 carries for 223 yards.
With another running back getting over 20 carries. And it's not like there were a couple of home run balls in there that dragged the average up. The long play from him on the day was 27, and McCray had one of 28. So this is...
I can't say enough about what an incredible statement this was, and it just totally changes everything for me, because this would be compared to the win against Wisconsin a couple years ago. Nothing like that. This was one on the road, two, much more dominant. Illinois didn't trail by two scores for most of this game. Three, this is year one, not year four.
Yeah.
And I get that it's been a long year, as things have come and gone, and Brett Bielema did admittedly do things that contributed to losing two games, but this more than makes up for it. This more than makes up for both the Maryland and the Purdue thing, because... we're almost certainly not going bowling. It's about perception now. It's about what can you sell to get. So now you can sell to all these, you know, linemen you're trying to recruit to the future. Hey, you know.
You want to run block?
You want to run block? You want to play some Big Ten bully? You want to play some big, fat Big Ten bully ball? Well, come here, kid. I'm going to get you in here. And, I mean, did you see all the times they came out with seven offensive linemen?
Yeah, lots. It was. I mean, I don't remember if we actually said this on the pod or if it was just something I said in jest to you, but I was like, you know, at what point, with how bad this passing game looks especially, does Bielema just consider bringing back that barge formation they used to use when they had, you know, Clay and Ball and all those guys? And it, like, they did it. They basically did. So, and that worked, yeah.
And an incredible performance on defense also from Tariq Barnes was everywhere. Devin Witherspoon had a couple of tackles for loss very late in the game.
All across the secondary and the back seven. Illinois had guys
outside of one specific drive where Jahan Dotson stole their lunch money.
Yeah, well, and then they had, I mean, the only touchdown Penn State score, really the only success they had on offense was Lambert Smith getting a slant, shaking his guy, and then because of the way the defense was, I think the safety might have blown the read on that play too, because he was kind of toasted
so hard that he just did one of those, you know, shit, I get him next time.
Yeah.
Just pulled up. So, giving Illinois a lot of credit. Now, let's talk about what went wrong for Penn State here, because Sean Clifford, I do not think, was anywhere near 100%.
No, he's obviously still hurt. And so there's a lot of criticism and scrutiny that should be aimed at James Franklin here, because in the Iowa game, he was injured enough that he had to come out before halftime, couldn't go back in. They had a bye week to evaluate him, watch what he looked like on the field, and they decided, yeah, Clifford at probably something less than 50% is definitely our best option here. This reminds me powerfully of Michigan State sending Brian Lewerke back into the game when he was obviously hurt, and they got murdered by Michigan because he couldn't throw the ball. And afterwards, D'Antonio's answer was, well, we basically leave it up to the player. It's like, what are you talking about? And I didn't hear any comments from Franklin after this game. I don't know what his rationale is going to be for sending Clifford back in, but either you didn't appreciate the extent of his injury, or despite him being healthy enough to play, this is still what you got. Like, there's no circumstance here where Franklin comes out looking good. Or you,
and I think there was a little element of this.
You probably
didn't think
you were going to need a full effort from the passing game.
Yeah. Which is fair, except at some point you have to look at the clock, look at the score, and realize, hey, we really need to put this game away.
And there's also the fact that it would be a big oversight here, because it's not like Illinois' defense for a month has been good now. This is not some Rutgers or Maryland game where you can expect to just roll the helmets out, run the ball 50 times and be good. And the other thing here is, remember, Penn State's run game has not been good this year.
Not in any juncture have they been good. And
they have needed,
Illinois has been decent against the run. I mean, outside of the Virginia game and just some individual, I mean, they had one very bad drive in this game, but just one. They really have tightened up a lot and done a lot to limit explosive plays against Maryland and Purdue.
And even the couple of big plays that Penn State did hit were really more about the receivers making individual outstanding plays.
Well, I mean, in that really bad drive, Clifford basically threw an interception that Jahan Dotson went up and stole from Jartavis Martin.
Yeah.
I mean, he threw an arm punt.
And here's the other thing that's got to be said, which, look, when you score 18 points in 9 overtimes, defense is generally going to be towards the back of the line for concerns, but Penn State's linebackers were pretty damn bad in run defense today, which is a weird thing to say because Brooks and Smith and Lucetta have been really good all season, but they were not shedding blocks. They were missing their run fits. And so you've got, I mean, let me scroll. And again, knowing that the box score isn't necessarily correct here, I mean, you've got Joey Porter making 9 tackles. Brisker had to make 8. Like, the running backs for Illinois were getting into the secondary a lot.
Yeah, there were an awful lot of tackles by defensive backs. And yes, I get the other team is always trying to, but this is an offensive line for Illinois that had really struggled in making second-level blocks, not been able to get, you know, and you have your zone concepts you always want one of your double team blockers to get to the second level. That just that kind of thing just hasn't been happening. You haven't seen pulling guards or anything get to where their men are. I mean,
yeah, and that's why I'm
there's just been so much that they've been unable to execute.
And so I'm hesitant to give them too much of a pass for losing PJ Mustafa, even though he's an excellent player, for two reasons. One, again, you had the bye week. You've recruited plenty of talent that you should have been able to cover for him a little better. And second, because of the X's and O's of this particular game, Illinois is not running power up the middle all that much. It's not like they're double-teaming Mustafa's replacement and pushing him out of the way, and that was a big weakness. It's that they're running these stretches to the outside, and Penn State's linebackers are not scraping and getting to the ball carrier.
Yeah, and they did. I mean, I don't want to say, like, oh, they did the thing I said they should do. It's because I was far from the only person making these observations. I was far from the only person making these observations of, like, well, they really should have tested the edge in some of these situations where they didn't. I mean, they were giving Chase Brown the opportunity to get outside. They were doing more creative things with the running game. And I think that they must have just had a real kind of come-to-Jesus moment with their offensive line over this bye week, because they did an awful lot better. But still, I mean, Penn State, much more talented, much more deep. Really shocking that at no point were they really able to put the clamps on and stop them from eating huge portions of clock.
Yeah, and you know, it's but so to circle back to that offensive line thing for a moment there, you mentioned, of course, that Bielema caught a lot of flack for some comments that pretty much everyone interpreted as, oh man, he's really just lighting his offensive lineman on fire. No, he was kind of speaking the truth. It's a literal truth.
But what he said and, was, he fumbled his words a little bit, but
sure.
What he basically was saying was, hey, the guys that were here before me, basically all the guys they recruited to play offensive line from 2018 to 2020, they're all gone now.
Yeah, and that's like, there's nothing incorrect about that. So it was, to me, another example of national media types hunting for grievances. It reminded, you know what it reminded me of? You can probably guess what it reminds me of. Guess.
Oh, the Michigan's the Tom Izzo thing?
Yeah, exactly. It reminds me of, oh man, Tom Izzo shouldn't yell at Aaron Henry, and then he has the best game of his life in the next game.
Yeah.
Like, I understand.
Look, if there was an opportunity for me to pile on Brett Bielema prior to this one.
Oh, you would have taken it. Yeah.
You know, I would have taken it. I was pretty mad about the way he's gone.
Justifiably so, because as you mentioned, if they approach a couple games differently, they could be 5-3 and 3-1 in the conference right now.
That being said, this was the game I thought they maybe had the least chance to win out of the ones that they had left on their schedule. This or Iowa.
Yeah, it's on paper the toughest opponent you have left, but
so,
it is true that you've got a wounded opponent, and man, beyond the decision with Clifford himself, that Franklin and his offensive staff didn't have one of the backups ready to play after a bye week, knowing that your quarterback was hurt, and seeing what your offense looked like without Clifford.
Well, and remember what
Iowa.
We said about it was that we just thought that maybe they just didn't prep Roberson with the ones,
yeah,
right? And that was something they'd surely get fixed in the bye week, knowing that Clifford's status might be up in the air, knowing that they can't go into a situation like this unprepared, knowing that they were going to have to play on the road in Columbus the following week,
right.
Might have to get him in there. And it looks like they just said, nah, we're never going to have to play him again.
Apparently so.
So we actually gave James Franklin and the Penn State staff way too much credit.
Yeah. Oh, and I don't remember if I actually got this thought out or not, because there's like lots to cover here, but one of our new Penn State contributors, Mr. Evis, pointed out James Franklin has never lost a game at Penn State without immediately losing another one after it.
Yeah, that is
which is
true.
That's a great pull by him.
And it also is amazing how much it goes against what he claims his philosophy is.
Yeah, which is, oh, we're just, every game is Akron, right?
So. Yep. Oh, no, it's the same as playing Akron. Yeah. No, because if that's true, then
your team ought to be able to get over a loss a little better then.
Yeah, especially with a bye week in the middle. Because
yeah.
That is very damning. I mean,
I would say one last note on this, but again, like this game contains multitudes, and
because we haven't even gotten to the third aspect, which is all the shit that was just incredibly funny. For instance, three times in this game did somebody attempt a double reverse pass. Right? Illinois tried it twice with Casey Washington making the throws for some reason.
Yeah.
And in both cases, there was one where I thought, why didn't he throw that like a second sooner instead of tucking and running? And there was another one where I thought, why did he throw that at all?
Yeah. Well,
because he was lucky to not get picked off on both of them. And then the other one was in, I think, the third overtime. Penn State tried to throw back to Clifford.
They ran the Philly special.
They ran the Philly special, but instead it looked like when the Patriots ran it. Do you remember Tom Brady just out there by himself, just, oh no, my hands don't work.
Because the ball didn't hit him in the face mask. Yeah.
I mean,
the last thing here, and because of the way the game turned out, this will easily be lost to the sands of time, and that's fine, but there was a sequence early in the fourth quarter that, had Illinois lost this game, would be the kind of thing that spawns conspiracy theories, because twice on the same drive, Illinois had touchdown plays called back for extremely questionable penalties, and it was the kind of thing where it feels like, okay, so the refs just aren't going to let my team score, no matter what. That's how this game is going to go now.
Yeah, because there was one where it was, in my opinion, a pretty light hold on the other side of the play. Well, and then, you know, I mean, you can never nitpick individual calls. For me, it's about the context of the game. I just want it to be consistent. For instance, you can't decide on that drive, we're going to call everything now. But then you let go a holding against Daniel Barker on what ended up being their last offensive play of that drive. I mean, the rules have to stay consistent throughout the game, but they certainly have to stay consistent throughout a drive.
Right, and as you say, so like they call three, because then between the two calls that wiped out touchdowns, they called one on Penn State for defensive face mask, which it totally was. And then, as you say, they let go what probably would have been the weakest call of all of them. Because there was some contact, yes, but it's also the kind of thing where if they throw that flag, it's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. But again, to be consistent with what they were then calling the game, like, we complain about this in basketball all the time, which is just, could you be the same from the first half to the second so we don't go from a free-flowing, entertaining basketball game to both teams in the double bonus with 12 minutes left? Like, can we at least get that? And we can't. Because as long as these conferences can get away with cutting corners and not paying full-time refs, that's what they're going to do, and the product is going to suffer for it, and we're still going to tune in, because we're suckers. So that's, I mean, you have any final thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, near the end of the game, just before that that bizarre would-be game-tying drive that where Illinois decided the most prudent thing to do is to not let Art Sitkowski throw a pick six here.
And they were, very correct.
In order to set that up, they first had to field a punt where, of course, they Illinoised it. And Donnie Navarro completely missed it. Donnie Navarro has been remarkably consistent with the punt returns, just not this time. And what ended up happening was a walk-on now a scholarship player, but a walk-on who earned his scholarship after living in his car for a bit, ended up, you know, Johnny on the spot, getting that ball and not running back into the end zone. Just a phenomenal heads-up play to save a muffed punt that I thought, I mean, you know how I am with Illinois and muffed punts.
Understandably so. And, you know, one more rules note we're on that point. I think you should be able to advance a muffed punt. I don't understand the rationale for that. I think the more crazy stuff that's allowed to happen, the better. That seems like a rule that's anti-fun, and so I hate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, another big problem for this game, and one that by the time this happened, I just wanted us to beat Penn State to punish them for ruining this, was Art Sitkowski landed very, very awkwardly on his wrist in something that looked really, really bad.
In like the sixth or seventh overtime, and he
Of course, after just badly missing a wide open Jakari Norwood.
Yeah, and it was a tricky throw. Don't get me wrong, but it's a a throw that a Division I quarterback should be able to make.
Well, the reason that he didn't make it is again because he makes every throw a step late. Had he thrown it as soon as he saw Norwood's man leaving to come and cover him, you know, easy throw and catch.
Yeah.
But instead, he kind of
waited until the guy was close enough to like block all the passing lanes.
He wasn't
lanes.
Sure if he could make it in, and then he just kind of, you know, and ended up. So the problem is that Sitkowski, who it looks like Brandon Peters was healthy, so they started Sitkowski over Peters, which means that would have happened for Illinutgers next week.
Yeah.
And now Sitkowski's status is in question, and I already made the logo, and it involves Art Sitkowski. So that's ultimately why you lost the game, Penn State, is because you ruined Illinutgers for me. So So good.
Okay.
And one more fun thing.
Jeez. Okay. All right.
Yet one more is okay. that comparisons online ask the question, this game or 6-4 when talking about worst Penn State losses. And the funniest thing is that nobody even mentioned the time that he lost to Tim Beckman as his worst loss.
Well, that was still... wasn't that his first year?
Yeah, but he got outcoached by Tim Beckman. I mean, he did. He really did. He sure. refused to run the ball with Akil Lynch just running dudes over on fourth and short. So what do you think? What would you rather watch, this game or 6-4?
Gosh. At least this game it featured the Illinois running game, right?
Yeah.
And so despite the low score and how long it went, I think this is probably still the better, more entertaining game, and this is probably where we lose what's left of our Iowa listenership. Thank God.
Well, also the winning coach in this game smiled after it.
Yes, that's true. That's true. All right. I think at this point we have to move on. So fortunately there are a few other games where there's a couple in here that there's going to be some detail on, but let's go through one that's going to be pretty quick. Northwestern 7, Michigan 33. This, however, was, I believe, a 10-7 game at halftime, or it might have, something like that.
Well, Moon kept up for a bit.
A while.
Moon was fairly persistent.
It was looking like a possibility.
Moon happened throughout the entire first quarter. Moon is also a dog who's in the corner of my room right now. And is
you... Call my name. Yeah.
Moon, you're way better as a dog than a football game.
Yeah, scoreless first quarter, 10-7 Michigan at halftime, and then 23-0 Wolverines after the break. So, some weird... So, first of all, the Michigan angle, I think, is easier here. Once again, they're not showing much in the passing game. Once again, their supporters and fanboys will justify this as, oh, we're just not putting anything on tape. I don't know about that, man. I still think you want a little bit more in the way of rhythm. And I guess, look, in a game like this, do you really want your quarterback to throw it more than 27 times? No, but 27 attempts for 129 yards is probably not a passing game that's going to beat Michigan State. I'm not saying they can't do better than that, but they haven't shown the ability to in a competitive game situation.
Cade McNamara is kind of the quarterback that they need in order to win games because remember that Michigan is Iowa. Okay? And so they need a quarterback that's just not going to turn the ball over. Michigan fans all think that Tom Brady is the best quarterback who's ever played the game. And that's literally the only thing he does well is he quarterback sneaks and he doesn't throw a lot of interceptions unless it's the playoffs.
Right.
That's his only strength.
You're out on a little bit more of an island on that take. At some point.
Point is, though, Cade McNamara even admits that, no, his primary concern is not losing the game, which is something that for Purdue is not what you want in a quarterback. But for a team that's got a strong defense that they believe in a lot and a running game that they think is their foremost offensive identity, it's kind of the attitude that you really want the guy to have.
And that's understandable at the beginning of the season or a month in when it's worked and you've won every game big. After you've played Rutgers and Nebraska and seen your running game be shut down for large stretches and then your offense is completely unable to do anything, it seems like something you might want to change your approach to if you have big goals, which at number 6 and 7-0 in the country, you really ought to have big goals right now. But they're not playing like it. Again, it's hard to be mad about a 26-4 score victory here, but we'll see. We'll see if this ends up biting them. I don't think they're beating Michigan State if they're not throwing the ball for bigger plays. And it's not to say they can't, but they haven't.
The thing is, at the end of the day, they won by 4 scores. And 7 years ago, they were coached by Brady Hoke. So where would you rather be now?
Okay, look. True. No question. Even with Brady Hoke's career renaissance.
Got my Gettysburg reference in there.
From the Northwestern perspective, I don't know that it would have made a difference. I think the talent difference here was too much for them to overcome. But I didn't really understand the game plan here. They had some success on the ground when they ran it. And they also hit a couple of chunk plays through the air. And so Their offensive game plan centered around short passes that Hilinski is kind of not that great at because he misplaces the ball too frequently for those plays to work. Opening drive of the game, they complete like about a 30-yard pass, I think, down the field. And then after that, run for short gain, pass for short loss, incompletion, punt. And that latter sequence was what they did with most of their offensive plays. So because they're not running the ball productively, they're not hanging on to the ball, they're not taking as many shots downfield as you should, because I still think the corners on this Michigan defense are vulnerable, and that's why I feel pretty good about this weekend's matchup.
Hold on. Evan Hull had a 75-yard run, and yet he finished with 6 carries for 81 yards?
Yeah.
Which means that he got 6 yards on his other 5 carries?
Yeah.
Okay.
Still better than Hilinski throwing
yep.
for sub 50% completions for, what, 4 or 5 yards?
In That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's a big outlier.
No, I get that. Yeah, I get that it drags numbers up, but in 6 attempts. Like, you're confident that he's going to break a couple of longer runs if he's given the opportunity. I do think it has to be said that this Northwestern offensive line is not going to get much better. I don't think they have a better option at quarterback. Unless and until Andrew Marty's healthy. But
Yep, they've got him in one of those Dragon Ball Z healing tanks that's gonna come up in just about a month. He'll be ready.
For sure.
I can't wait for Marty Ball. So
I don't think there's much else to say about that game, though. There's probably no Northwestern game script that's gonna result in a win here. And I understand why in a 4-score win It's a lesser complaint for Michigan, but given what you've seen from Ohio State now, do you think that if Michigan plays with this kind of game script, they're going to have a chance of beating Ohio State?
No, but I also think that if they find themselves tied to trailing late, that they will change the game script. I don't think they were compelled to here. I don't think they were really compelled to against Rutgers because Rutgers never tied it up. I don't think that they've ever really been compelled to and needed to do this to win. Now, have they been compelled to and needed to do this to look better, win more commandingly? Maybe, but man, a win's a win's a win. We thought Jim Harbaugh would be fighting for his job at this point.
Yeah, it's true. Look, there's no getting around the fact that they've played vastly better than expected.
He's a value investment now that you know what? Maybe that was it. Maybe it's just that his inflated salary kind of shut down the Sigma male grind set in his brain, right?
Okay.
So now he realizes he's gotta hustle every day. He's gotta grind. He's gotta rise and grind. Get this bread. You know, now that he's not making as much as he was before.
Yeah, I'm sure he's living paycheck to paycheck at this point and merely making $5 million a year or whatever it is.
Sigma male trillionaire grind set is what's resurged in Harlow's brain.
I'm sure he's going to be eager to tell us all about the importance of having an LLC.
Well, look, if he wins next week, then he will evolve beyond a Sigma male and into a Ligma male.
I'm not biting. I'm not taking that. Yeah. Well, and the other thing is,
you better not be biting.
If he does win next week, maybe I don't have to hear any more Mel Tucker to LSU bullshit, because that's not going to happen. So, not much else to say about that one. Next one, I actually have a surprising amount to say about, considering the teams involved and that the box score kind of tells the whole story. Maryland 16, Minnesota 34. Let's start on the Maryland side of this one.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, Quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This probably would have been a more competitive game, but there's a couple of recurring problems here. The first is that, especially since Demas went down, and I get that now they're short Jashawn Jones as well, the receivers they've got left are dropping balls at critical moments. Their tight end Okonkwo had a big drop. Who the hell was the other guy? I don't remember.
Talking about Jarrett?
Not the guy I'm thinking of. I know that but they had receivers dropping passes in critical moments in this game. Their offense does not operate at a good enough margin to have that kind of mistake. And the other thing is, from a coaching perspective here, they remain a massively undisciplined team. I think 8 penalties for about 80 yards in this game. And then the frequency with which their guys look around for flags in disbelief after unsuccessful plays. I get that that happens on pretty much every incomplete pass. The receiver's looking for a flag. It just feels like it happens more often with them. I mean, maybe it's nothing. It shouldn't be news by now that you're not getting calls on the road in this league, though. And then the other thing, sort of a big picture note here, and I believe our own DJ Carver pointed this out in the Slack early on. He was not able to watch games, kind of popping in and out. But he made some comments on basically their alignments versus certain run fronts. And yeah, I noticed as well. For example, one sticks out to me. The last play of the third quarter, Maryland's already trailing. Minnesota's rolling downhill like a ball of knives on the ground. Maryland has 6 guys in the box on 2nd and 8. What the hell did you think was going to happen?
Yeah.
Minnesota doesn't want to throw it. Their run game is doing gangbusters. Even down their top 2 running backs, they're still obviously going to try to run the ball as much as they possibly can.
You just keep giving them room.
And you're throwing a 6-man box on a standard down. I mean, like, what are you doing?
Chris Ottman-Bell had 4 receptions for 35 yards. Point being, you didn't make them go to him.
No, they didn't have to. Because Maryland's running so... And look, I get, like, Brandon Jennings is hurt, and it's a big loss. He's a freshman linebacker. You got to have more depth than that at this point in your program. I get that it's year 3 and COVID dropped in right in the middle of their development curve. Hasn't bothered Shiano or Tucker the same way. Those two guys, I mean, I don't think Rutgers is as talented of a team as Maryland yet, but is it not easy to, like, who in the East right now would you say is in a worse position than Maryland is in terms of where their program is in its arc? Is there anybody?
The only reason that I say Maryland is because it's not clear what the upside is. With Indiana, you've seen it. You saw the last couple of years they did pretty well. They're in a down. I mean, this year does raise a lot of questions for me about how well Tom Allen can sustain it. But the point is,
yeah. You
see what he's been able to achieve. You can, you know, and he can point to that. With Rutgers, you've got Shiano's pedigree. You've got just how much he elevated the exact same recruits.
Yeah, how quickly they went from a complete clown show to at least looking competent, if not
so
talented.
What he can say pretty credibly is, look, man, these coaches will put you in the best situation to win. What's Maryland really going for here? Like, that's what's not been clear is what the upside is.
Yeah.
They've got some opportunities, but when I say some opportunities, I mean they've got 2 games they have to win. They have to beat Indiana, and they have to beat Rutgers, because I do not think they're going to win any of their other games.
Yeah, and so as you mentioned, they're after that 4-0 start, still on 4 wins as we approach the end of October. Remaining schedule, they have Indiana at home next week, then Penn State. That's more of a game that could be up in the air. And then they go to Michigan State, host Michigan, and go to Rutgers.
The end it of certainly they need, seems they need like 2 Penn of those State wins. Could be up in the air. But, I mean, you've seen their offense come in with a critical weakness. People have been able to exploit it. Will Maryland do it? I mean, you just saw them against an offense that's got kind of kind of one-dimensional, and they didn't.
Or did they? Yeah,
didn't stack up to stop the run there.
Right. Or against Penn State with an injured quarterback, do they continue to, you know, drop deep safeties and play dime packages like that? That would.
So yeah, I mean, Penn State at home could be gettable. I certainly think that against Indiana at home and at Rutgers, are by far their biggest challenge. I don't think there's a chance in hell they beat Michigan State on the road home against Michigan. Those are sure losses. And, you know, it's hard to really hold losses to Iowa and Ohio State, you know, as indictments of Moxley.
Sure. But losing to a Maryland team that theoretically is around where you should be in the pecking order.
Minnesota loss is a bit more concerning. Because if you don't really get to a bull here, then it's really hard to see Mike Loxley kind of pulling out. I mean, because the one thing usually what you have working for you when you're in a dive is that your airspeed is at the very least increasing, right? So that means in theory that's more control if you can actually get the air to your control surfaces. But at a certain point, you lose altitude. And if you lose too much altitude, there's nothing you can do to recover.
And to translate that to a win-loss record, this loss drops him to 10-20 overall as Maryland coach now. And it's true that Loxley has raised the talent level there, but there's got to be some goals at some point. And look, towards the end of the game, the broadcast was trying to be charitable and put some lipstick on this pig, basically, and threw some kind of generalized praise in the direction of, oh, he's building the culture. You know what their culture was against Minnesota yesterday? 5 personal foul penalties that were accepted.
Ouch.
Including 2 block in the backs on a punt return that otherwise might have gotten them back in the game. And does
that's
this not...
brutal.
And
so does you got the, 22 minutes time of possession, losing the turnover battle, yet outgained by nearly 200.
And does that not line up with...
79 yards rushing to 326.
This lines up with what we expected. When they hired Loxley, we were like, okay, yeah, they're going to be really talented, but they're going to misuse their talent, and they're going to be really undisciplined. And here we are, well into year 3, and that's what's happened.
And, you know, it might sound like we've been rooting for him to fail. Frankly, I'd love to see him succeed because I like when a variety of approaches can be successful. I don't like this idea that there's exactly one way that you can do it, right? And
I have nothing against the guy. I mean, he's persona. Maybe the guy doesn't mean anything to me.
Hey, he was the offensive coordinator on the last good Illinois football team 14 years ago.
You know what I disliked about this hire from the beginning is that it was uncreative thinking. Because it's a guy who has, like, oh, you're bringing the guy who's going to be the local recruiter, who's got
that's
his track record in the Big Ten.
Hire as your offensive coordinator.
Yeah, or as a guy, or as a position coach who only recruits.
Yeah, that's...
And speaking of, by the way, to put a bow on this before we turn to the Minnesota angle here, we talked about the tons of talent angle. And they've got a lot of that talent on campus now, which is a good thing. Because right now, the 22 recruiting class is 13th in the conference, 55th nationally. And part of that is that it's going to be small. They only have, I think, 11 guys committed. And I don't know what their scholarship matrix situation is. Who can know that anymore, by the way?
But the thing is, if they're that low in the Big Ten with still 11 guys, I mean, because it's still somewhat early, then that means that they don't have any groundbreaking recruits, right? They don't have a Rakeem Jarrett, do they?
No. I think they only have a couple of guys who are even blue chips. So... There's not more help on the way, and it's true that all
got
this
gotta win 2 more games. You've got to make a bowl here.
Yeah, because
you just can't afford to miss a bowl game.
The hope here, is that you've got all the talent you're going to have in the near future on campus now. A lot of those young guys are playing. Those practices and that extra game could be extremely valuable. And I know that angle is like every TV broadcast that covers a team that's out of the conference race or out of the national playoff picture says, well, man, you know, going to a bowl really means a lot to these kids, these coaches. I don't know if most of them care much, but those extra practices are helpful. They really are. So,
well, no, you say that coming from a Michigan State perspective, Maryland doesn't make bowls all the time. Illinois doesn't make bowls all the time. It means something when you make a bowl at a school that just doesn't. You know, you look over there and the section where they got the bowls listed is really fucking small.
Yeah.
Right?
All right.
Nobody was on campus. Nobody played in the 2014 and the 2019 bowls for Illinois. There's nobody that did that. Maryland's last bowl game was, did they get to one in 2018? No, they didn't. Because that was the one where they would have if they had beaten Dwayne Haskins Ohio State, and they almost did. I mean, point is, it does mean a lot if... It's just not something that happens all the time.
Yeah.
And it means a lot when it's the first time a coach has gone to a bowl game.
That's true. So, yeah.
On the other side, Minnesota is 5-2 and they are currently tied with Iowa for first place in the Big Ten West.
And none of the games between Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin have happened yet. So
nope.
Between Iowa's loss last week and now Purdue turning around and being like, yeah, no, thank you, we're not going to participate in the race this year, we've suddenly got the triangle of hate, because Nebraska is thoroughly out of the picture, as the front runners, and how they do against each other determines everything. So,
well, hold on here. Purdue has the same conference record as Wisconsin. So if Wisconsin's got anything to say about it, so does Purdue.
But Purdue also has the head-to-head loss to one of these teams that I was talking about. That's what I was referring to.
Actually, to two of these teams, yes.
Yeah. Is because, and because of that, it's more difficult to envision.
So if they beat up on each other, then there could be a weird-ass quadrangle, and then all, and then as many damaging losses as happened last week, in the last week of the season, as is possible, and Illinois wins it at, like, 5-4 conference record.
Okay. I guess we can go with that.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure that's very possible. Before we get into a little bit of praise for Fleck here in keeping this run game going, I have to say this because I asked you during this game, has the pre-half clock management thing, is that like a new thing where it's a problem like every week and it jumps out like a sore thumb or like a huge visible like siren in the sky? Or is it just because of the attention you called to it when Bielema did it that now I'm looking for this and it's more visible?
Well, it might also be longer than that, because the most famous one from recently is Lovie Smith, "We were content" against Nebraska in the first half, just not even trying. Lovie Smith was the king, okay? Brett Bielema's got nothing on him for squandering the end of a first half.
Well, that's all well and good, but keep in mind, we are actually talking about Minnesota right now.
But
so
that's my point. It's like, it's come on my radar a lot over the last few years, and I think that's why.
So PJ Fleck handled, here's the two-minute situation we have. So Minnesota gets the ball after a pretty good punt, I think. I don't even know if it was a punt or a kickoff. I don't remember, but they get the ball deep in their own territory, like the 20 or 25. First play of the drive, they complete like a 20-plus yard pass. All of a sudden, with the where they are in the field and the time that's left, it is very possible to get into the end zone with the amount of time you have left. But instead, they call 8 consecutive runs on the rest of the drive to drain the clock all the way down and basically just set themselves up for a field goal attempt as time expires. And then what happens? The field goal is blocked. And only because of a very lucky series of bounces did Maryland not pick it up and run it back for a game-tying touchdown as the first half came to a close. The home field crowd, which, by the way, was very sparse for what looked like a nice day in Minnesota, lustily booed. Good for them. I'm on board with that. And anyone who says you shouldn't boo a college team is full of it, because college players are smart enough to know they're not booing the players. They're booing the chicken shit coach.
Yep, exactly.
So anyway, all that being said, I had to get that out because this clock management thing is like, it seems like
you're playing whack-a-mole to a greater extent than you thought you would every week. Except that every time you think that you processed it, actually now there's two more over here, and you realize that this thing goes all the way to the top.
I'm starting to think there's no coach in the conference who won't do, because we see, like, Bielema did it, yeah, and I know Lovie Smith used to do it, but Mel Tucker's done this, we've now seen PJ Schiano's done it. Like, is there anybody in this conference who's going to prove that they know how to handle the end of a clock?
It's comorbid with terminal NFL brain, and you look in the Big Ten, oh yeah.
But it's so weird, because, like, okay, so again, I get it from, like, Tucker spent a decade coaching in the NFL. Schiano was in the NFL for a while, unsuccessfully. PJ Fleck, what was he, like, an assistant coach for a year in the NFL or something? Like, he shouldn't be...
Under Greg Schiano.
Oh, okay. All right, you know what? We've identified that. So,
yep,
Greg Schiano...
Schiano... It all flows from Schiano.
Schiano is patient zero in this end-of-half brain worm that we've got at the... So, all right, anyway... I don't mean to make that.
Are you suggesting that Schiano then infected Lovie Smith because all of his germs were still in the Tampa Bay facility?
Oh. Oh, shit.
Whoa.
Okay, all right.
Wisconsin 30, Purdue 13.
Oh, no, we're not done here. We're not done here.
Oh, okay.
Because, like I said, it does have to be said, okay, that notwithstanding the fact that their game flow should have made it obvious that they were going to do nothing but run the ball, this is a situation where I don't necessarily blame... So the difference between Minnesota using this game plan and Michigan using it is... I don't know that there's a better approach for Minnesota to take, because other than getting Chris Ottman Belmore involved, what other compelling options do they have? Whereas Michigan, I get that Ronnie Bell is hurt, but you got Roman Wilson back. You still have A.J. Henning, Cornelius Johnson, Eric Gall, a tight end who can supposedly catch the ball. Like, they've got lots of options who we know can be good. That Minnesota takes this kind of game plan makes more sense given their strength, because their offensive line's run blocking is really good. I get that Michigan's is too. But yeah, credit has to be given here, because even after losing Mo Ibrahim early with the injury, Trey Potts to the medical issue, they've now had their fourth and fifth running backs of the season have 100-yard games as Kai Thomas and Bucko Irving, by the way. Awesome new nickname Bucko. That I was not previously aware
Listen
of.
Listen here, Bucko.
How many times do you think... So I wonder if that's a nickname he had also in high school, and I just picture him as like the preternaturally talented but surly teenager who his coach is just like, Bucko! Like, yeah. Listen here, Bucko, you're going to run laps until... And he just runs laps endlessly and never gets tired, and they can't discipline him because he's just physically invincible to their punishments. And so, yeah, like, anyway.
Well, what I wonder is if he has any playing history with that defensive back from Arkansas. Listen here, Buster Brown.
Yeah, talk about a name that makes you impervious to
Being talked down to by Midwestern adults.
To angry coaches from boomers, yeah. And so the last thing we would say about Minnesota here is that the conference loss they have to Ohio State is cross-divisional, and with nobody in the West running the table, again, this round-robin amongst Iowa and Minnesota and Wisconsin is almost certainly going to decide the divisional champ. Or maybe one of them hilariously trips over Northwestern. That would be funny to me, too. So, yeah, now we will move on to Wisconsin and Purdue. Badgers 30 and Boilermakers 13. And here, so this game started before the Illinois-Penn State game was over. And by the time I flipped over to it, it was close to the end of the first half. And each team had already turned it over twice by that point, and it just made me think of the Omni-Man meme where, like, this game is the jet fighter approaching in the distance, and I picture, like, Bielma's face transposed over Omni-Man, and he's like, look what they need to mimic a fraction of our sicko.
So, here's something I found interesting. Do you know who's got the least points allowed in conference games in the Big Ten overall?
I'm going to guess Wisconsin.
No, it's actually Penn State at 53. Somehow. Yeah, Penn State has a very... But Penn State's got... advanced stats say Penn State's defense is top 10.
We'll see what they look like after this week's update.
Tied at second with... No, that's after this weekend. For
okay.
Well, the SP Plus isn't, but the points allowed is.
All right.
At 53, they're by far the fewest. But tied at second with 66 points allowed are the Purdue Boilermakers.
I believe it. I believe it.
Wisconsin has it. Well, oh, oops. That's third. Iowa's allowed 64. Sorry, Iowa people. You can uncancel us now. I thought you people were against cancel culture.
Yeah, so I was told. As far as this game goes, though, talk about knowing who you are. In the first half, Purdue ran the ball outside of the sacks that O'Connell took three times in the first half for a total of 3 yards. So understandable why they weren't really leaning on that in the game script. Even though in the first half they threw two interceptions and only had about a little more than 7 yards per completion. And then on the other side of the ledger, Wisconsin only threw it six times before halftime. And then in the third quarter, they went 0-for-2 on passes. So of Wisconsin's 35 plays in the first half, they gave the ball to Malusi 19, and that's when he's going for about 3.5 yards a carry. So I guess you're going to have to give some credit, I guess, to Paul Chris for sticking with the only thing that could plausibly work, because as the game went on, Purdue's defense did obviously wear down, and Malusi, and especially Braylon Allen, is a little bit more of a big play potential. They started breaking off longer runs. Allen ended up with a 70-yarder. And those long runs are going to drag up Wisconsin's average. But look, for a while, Purdue's defense hung in. And then, kind of like as we saw in the Notre Dame game, they ground down towards the end. There's still a depth problem here. And this is, I think this is the third time this year that Purdue has ended up at 13 points. Now, one of them was a win over Illinois. But for an offensive-minded head coach who has David Bell, this is a problem. This is a consistent problem. And this wasn't the... was it raining in this game? I don't think this was even a bad weather game.
So, I mentioned, of course, third in the conference was 66 points allowed in conference games.
Yeah.
It was just in conference games. Sure. But also in conference games, they've scored 63 points, which is less than 66, and also a problem.
Yeah. And it comes back to...
That's
something,
an average of just under 16 points a game.
Yeah, and this is something that we commented on earlier in the season, which is that the level of play from this offensive line is frankly not good enough to win consistently in the Big Ten. That's all there is to it. They might have the occasional game where they're able to scheme things up. You know, again, they had a masterful plan for Iowa, and so things worked then. But they are not consistently going to run the ball against the better run defenses that they face. This passing game is still fun to watch and interesting when it works, but O'Connell is a limited quarterback in that he will throw interceptions and he will take sacks, and that blows up a lot of drives. So even with the production they're capable of generating through the air, they're also very capable of, you know, racking up a lot of yards and not turning them into points because of those drive-killing plays where
yeah,
it's
I don't
pick
quite have that much information on their yards, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. Of course, another big story for this game is emerging Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year candidate, and which also is intersecting with one of my wife's favorite player candidates, only because his name is Chanel number 5. His name is Leo Chanel. He wears number 5. It's close enough. He had 5.5 TFLs in this game. 3.5 sacks on 9 total tackles.
Yeah,
but 5.5 TFLs is I mean, that's a pretty decent season.
No, Purdue's offensive line had no answers for him, and that's, again...
And Jack Sanborn also contributed, but Leo Chanel has been said his name a lot.
Hey, those two, again, it's this chain of linebackers that Wisconsin has produced. They're not only elite in college, but end up being really good in the NFL. Like, those two guys are obvious second, third round type NFL draft choices to me, but I don't know. I mean, maybe the Lions are better drafting another linebacker from Hawaii and see how that goes for them.
Well, no, what they're going to do is they're going to draft Kayvon Thibodeau and then hope that they have what he would call a, quote, great fucking team. I don't know if you heard his interview, but they just decided he gets the F-bomb pass because he's transcendent in all world and also can't convince me that the Lions don't have a pretty decent stranglehold on that top overall pick.
Oh, yeah, I don't know who they're beating this year. They'll accidentally win a couple games because you almost can't. And it's a 17-game schedule now. It's harder by a considerable margin to go unwin in the NFL than it has been in the past.
So Wisconsin also asked themselves the question, you know, earlier than Illinois did, of why aren't we running the ball all the time because our quarterback is a liability. Graham Mertz got 8 passing attempts.
Yeah, and in a game that they won easily. And
ultimately, you know, I know Purdue was sort of a trendy pick, but if you're looking for anything like a betting tip here, here's one of the easiest ones you can do, and that is take somebody that just got a massive upset, okay, because Purdue was hyped up a lot against Wisconsin. It was ranked Purdue against unranked Wisconsin, but who said that Wisconsin's not as bad as their record?
Wasn't Wisconsin still a favorite on the road, though?
Probably.
I don't think I made
that
up.
There was a reason.
Yeah.
And Purdue has now lost 15 straight to Wisconsin.
Yeah, I haven't beat them since 2003.
So when you've got a trend like that, I don't know. I just woke up too late to make my bets.
Yeah, well, they haven't beat them since Jim Leonard was a player in this series. So.
Yeah, so ultimately, we kind of... I'm not going to lie, I kind of expected this.
I probably should have. And it, like... I think I picked Purdue to win. I don't know why, looking back. Because honestly, it should have been an obvious result. Because you can't, and we've mentioned this before, but even guys like Nick Saban say, look, you can't get college kids up for their for a maximum effort every week. If you're lucky, you get two of those games a year. Well, Purdue definitely used one against Iowa. And expecting that kind of A-plus effort in back-to-back weeks is unrealistic.
It's actually, it reminds me of something that Jim Larrañaga said, one of my favorite things I've heard a college coach say, which is that, like, you know, you can't be expected to play up to your maximum potential, but what you'll always at least do is play down to how well you have the fundamentals executed, right? So that's
a very coach-speak thing to say, but there is truth there.
No, there's a lot. No, you can always count on your basic level of fundamentals as something to fall back on. So you can't really practice to get that maximum effort, that max. You can't practice to increase your ceiling. It's got to be of, you know.
You can practice to raise your floor, though.
Yep. That's basically what it is.
A lot of similarities between this game and the Maryland-Minnesota game here, because you have two teams who, whether by choice or by the reality of trying to lean on that passing game, do not have much going from the air, but were nonetheless able to dominate a conference opponent despite, again, anything from the passing game at all by grinding down opponents who could not run the ball themselves. It's, look, again, this is why a lot of coaches want to play this style in the Big Ten, because it works, especially if your opponent can't run the ball themselves.
So we've been at this a while, but don't have a whole hell of a lot to say about this last game.
Yeah, I just want to be quick.
Ohio State 54, Indiana 7. State's good, and Indiana is not. I mean,
well, I still...
I wish that it were more complicated than that. I wish it were more complicated than that.
In spite of everything, I still have some belief in Indiana's ability to turn this around. And I know at 2-5, with a trip remaining to Michigan, that's not a great position to be staking yourself to right now. And they have to sort out their offense to some extent here, because they scored to tie it up at 7 late in the first quarter and did virtually
nothing. I don't like totals.
And did virtually nothing off. Yeah, that's right. I mean, unless and until they get Michael Penix back at something resembling his old self, this offense is going to be bad. And it wasn't great with him.
And they clearly didn't believe that they had. I mean, who was this third string guy that they seem to have just been saving?
This freshman, Donovan McCauley.
Donovan McCauley, yes.
It's a true freshman, a dual threat guy, one of the guys who you can already hear the analysis, right? Oh, he's super raw, but lots of potential. Like, he's not the kind of guy who's going to help you stay in the game with Ohio State. So we'll continue with the Indiana angle for a second here. As we mentioned, they still have a trip to Michigan, but other than that, their remaining games at Maryland, Rutgers, Minnesota, both at home, and at Purdue. They need four of those games to make a bowl. That feels like the only way for this program to get its mojo back and kind of salvage this season.
It wasn't. Maryland-Indiana is one hell of an important game for both of these coaches. This is really a must-win. I mean, I don't think it's a must-win for Tom Allen's like legacy or whatever, but for this season.
Yeah.
They don't win that game, this season's over.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. Even though some of those games look winnable on paper, this offense has put up 28 total points in four Big Ten games.
That was the other jarring thing I saw when I looked up points there.
And that's, again, 15 of those were against Michigan State, which is a defense comparable to these others.
That's 18 less than Rutgers.
Yeah.
That's literally half of Northwestern.
Right.
So, as for Ohio State, I mean, you want to hear a lot of Ohio State talk, just turn on ESPN at any given time.
I will, yeah. I mean, the one thing that I thought was notable in this game is that
an entire media empire built around saying things to your fans.
It's already an extremely potent passing attack. Travion Henderson was already looking perfectly capable of carrying the load on the ground. And now they return Mayan Williams to the fold after he was out with a concussion for a couple weeks. So now they have two freshman eligibility running backs who are going to shove Master T, who's run for like 2,500 yards in his career, into the transfer portal. So if you need a running back, this is good news for you, because you can pick up Teague. But yeah, there's nowhere to hide statistically in this game. I mean, OSU did what has kind of been a little bit of a pattern with Ryan Day, which is in the first quarter, they're doing the Terminator vision thing. They're analyzing what you're doing. Yeah, they might score a touchdown or 10 points in the first quarter. You might be in a game with them. And then second quarter comes and they call an orbital bombardment, and it's just game over, 30-0 in the second quarter.
See, I'm glad that you compared it to that, because I was thinking more along the lines of Ken Shiro from Hokuto no Ken, and that is way cooler than Terminator. So, no, you definitely don't want to compare Ohio State to homeboy not really wanting to fight and just absorbing some moves and then coming up with a some kind of move and then doing the you are already dead. No, that's way too cool an analogy for Ohio State. You don't get that.
Nani?
My wa mo shinderu.
So the real question here is, does the West Division champ, who Ohio State dog walks in the conference championship game, still get the Rose Bowl even if they're like a 2 or 3 loss team? Or does Ohio State, obviously going to playoff, open the door for the winner of Michigan-Michigan State to get to the Rose Bowl despite not playing in Indianapolis? I am very excited for this possibility. Don't care, had Rose Bowl.
Your source for Big Ten Talk, it's Off Tackle Empire.